Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
From One World Trade Center in Manhattan, this is the New Yorker Radio Hour, a co-production of WNYC Studios and the New Yorker.
Welcome to the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. Around the time that Donald Trump was elected president, our staff writer Andrew Marantz took on a new beat. He's been covering the right-wing extremism that's burgeoning on the internet, the alt-right. It's a movement that embraces white supremacy, misogyny, homophobia, conspiracy theories, anti-Semitism, Islamophobia, you name it.
We are determined to take our country back. We're going to fulfill the promises of Donald Trump.
I mean, we have people who have been here for hundreds of years, people of African heritage who have not fully assimilated into the American society. Or
Hail Trump! Hail our people! Hail victory!
The rise of the alt-right is the subject of Andrew Marantz's new book, Antisocial: Online Extremists, Techno-Utopians, and the Hijacking of the American Conversation. And one of the things he's tried to understand is how people get radicalized into joining these hate groups. How does it happen, and to whom? Here's Andrew Marantz.
It took me a few years of reporting on these groups and this whole subculture before I really felt like I understood that. And one person who's really helped clarify a lot of that for me was this young woman whose first name is Samantha. We've been talking for a couple of years. Probably we've had hundreds of hours of conversations at this point. And her story has completely changed the way I think about these movements and who gets drawn into them and why.
I think that might be her.
So recently, Rhiannon Corby, who's a producer for the New Yorker Radio Hour, traveled a few hours away from New York, we're not going to say exactly where, and met Sam at the house where she's staying with family right now.
Hey, are you Sam?
I am.
How you doing?
I'm okay, how are you?
Good.
I was there on Halloween, and it was just like an incredibly blustery gray day, and I drive up, and she's just like sitting outside her porch, chain-smoking cigarettes. I think she was anxious. She was really anxious to talk.
It is hard to talk to people when you first get out. It's seemingly impossible. But, you know...
Just because you're afraid to tell people...
Yeah, you're afraid to, you spend all your time in there believing that you're right and that you see the truth and everyone else is missing it. And then when you get out and you realize that you've actually been entirely wrong the whole time, you're terrified to like you don't know, you kind of forget what it feels like to be so wrong. It took a long time for me to admit that I even liked being in there. Because I didn't go in for the politics. I didn't go in for racism. I went in because I was insecure and it made me feel good about myself.
Hi.
How are you?
Good. So that day when Rhiannon was visiting Sam, I called them from a studio in New York, and Sam talked us through the entire story of how she got into this from start to finish. Tell me about who you were before this whole thing started.
I was just kind of one of those, like, weirdos, you know? Like, I liked music.
Sam grew up in New Jersey, and then when she was halfway through high school, her family moved to the South. And it wasn't that she was a misfit, really. She had friends, but she was always looking for her place in things. So she would cycle through these different identities. She'd be really into being an athlete, and then she'd be really into being a kind of punk, and then she'd be really into indie movies.
I was just always searching for more, for my place, for that thing that's bigger than me, for me to fit in. But people seemed to generally like me. I went to parties. I hung out with everyone. I enjoyed myself. I was pretty left-leaning, almost annoyingly so.
So Sam was really close with her maternal grandmother, who was German, and who actually had grown up in the 30s in Germany and was part of Hitler Youth. So obviously Sam knew that that was horrifying, and yet, as horrifying as that part of her history was, she still wanted some way to connect with her German heritage.
you know, I have a very broad jaw and I have a very serious face when I'm not interacting with people. And I would, my excuse for everything was always, you know, I'm stoic because I'm German. I'm this because I'm German. Everything was always, oh, it's because I'm German.
So she finishes high school. She doesn't go to college. She starts working in service jobs, mostly in bars and cafes. And eventually she meets this guy. Now, in my conversations with Sam, we've called him Richie, but that's not his real name. So she meets Richie, and immediately this becomes the kind of relationship where it just feels like a really deep, instant connection.
I mean, I really felt like he loved me, and I felt like I belonged with him. And there was never any need to think that I needed to talk politics with him. There was never, like, we took a day off and drove to Atlanta to see Andrew Jackson Jihad, you know, which is a folk punk left-leaning, like, very, like, almost anarchist band. We love Neutromilk Hotel, which one of the albums is about, like, the Holocaust.
Yeah, their second album has songs from the perspective of a reincarnated Anne Frank.
Yeah.
You would think that somebody who loves that album is not going to become a Holocaust denier.
Everything that we loved together was just strange and different. And he had never said anything, at least for the first year that we were together, that gave me pause.
So at first, Richie's this really fun, life of the party kind of guy, really outgoing, knows how to play music, knows how to cook really well, knows how to dance. And then over time, he starts changing.
He had kind of buckled down a little bit. He was going to bed earlier. He was playing a lot of chess, reading a lot of Dostoevsky, which is fine. All of those hobbies are fine. But, you know, with this darker personality, and he like almost spoke in a lower register sometimes when he was serious. And he was much more unwilling to accept me making any mistakes. He just kept calling me a race traitor or a race baiter, which I had no idea what that meant. And then he just kept saying that he couldn't defend me on the day of the rope. Anytime that I did anything, it was always saying, I love you, but I can't defend you on the day of the rope.
Can you explain what the day of the rope is?
The day of the rope is a day that was written about in this book called The Turner Diaries. And what it says is that they also call it like white utopia or something like that. But it's where all cisgender, heteronormative, you know, fully abled white people find all people that don't fit that very narrow description and drag them out of their houses and hang them on lampposts.
So he was saying he couldn't save you should this
because I was a degenerate, because I liked to party, because I was friends with all kind of people, because I was sexually active before I met him. I could not reconcile it in my brain how this happened. So I went to his house, I asked if we could talk. We like sat down and I remember asking him what it meant, and he turned to me, and it was like he was testifying in court, and just looked at me dead in the eye and said, I think I'm a fascist and I don't want to be with anyone who's not. I just got my things and left.
And when you left, what were you thinking? Like, what was happening at that moment?
I mean, I got in the car and my first thought was like, well, obviously I can never be with him. And I was crying and I was like eating cigarettes. I was so upset. And I somehow, from the time that I got in the car to the time that I got out, I just convinced myself that I needed to understand where all of this, like what all of this actually is, like what, where is this coming from?
So as soon as she gets home, she opens up her laptop and she just starts reading everything she can find about the alt-right, listening to podcasts, watching videos on YouTube. She just wants to try to understand it.
I completely dove into it. You know, I skipped past most people's stages of getting into the far right. Like, I went straight into like Richard Spencer, David Duke, Nathan D'Amico, like all of these people that spoke calmly and spoke rationally and
And my intention originally was, you know, all right, I'm going to go in and I'm going to find these points and then I'm going to find the counterpoints and I'm going to confront him and we're going to have a discussion and he's going to be fixed. But that is not quite how it played out, so.
Some parts of the alt-right internet are just truly horrific and abhorrent, like the worst stuff you can imagine. But the stuff that Sam is looking at this point is a more kind of pseudo-intellectual, more buttoned-up version of the alt-right. Stuff like American Renaissance, the site that Jared Taylor runs, or Radix Journal, which was Richard Spencer's site, they're no less racist, but they dress it up in all kinds of pseudo-intellectual vocabulary, and in a way they're more dangerous because they don't immediately reveal themselves to be as odious as they are. But if you're someone who doesn't have much context, it's much easier to get drawn in by that stuff.
There was some interview on the Young Turks with Nathan D'Amigo, and he was just, I remember Nathan was just very calm, and he was saying like how he loves ethnic food, but he loves white people too.
I really enjoy about other cultures. I love lumpia. If anyone like wants to like ever make me happy, just a big pan of lumpia like will cheer me up.
Filipino delicacy.
Yes, very much so. So, you know, yeah, there are things that we can enjoy and that we can experience from other people. You know, however, you know, again, there is this other side in which there is this feeling of isolation.
When I was going through the motions of learning about the alt-right and learning about what all this stuff was, it was always marketed to me as this is just pro-white. There's no anti-anyone. We, you know, respect and show, you know, adherence for black, like we care about everyone else, that, you know, it had nothing to do with thinking that anyone was lesser than everyone. You know, there was some line where it was like everyone is superior in their own way. I remember calling my grandmother and talking to her about this and saying like, hey, you know, I'm talking to someone about these ideas and I don't know, like, what do you think? Like, you went through a war, you've had this full and vibrant life, and like, what are your thoughts on these things? And she was like, you know, that's, you know, Nazism is horrible. Like, she point blank called it out for what it was. And I just remember, and I remember telling her like, you know, should I feel bad for being white? And she paused and she said, you should never apologize for who you are. And I took that line and just ran with it and said, I am pro-white. I'm not anti anyone else. I'm not a Nazi. I'm not anything. I'm just pro-white. I am for my people. And that was the okay that I took to join. I remember calling him and I was just like, you know, I looked at all the sites, I looked at everything that you said, and let's do this.
So once Sam decided that she wanted to go down this road, she decided to make it formal because that's kind of how she is. She describes herself as a tryhard.
And so I looked into Identity Europa, and I think like a day or two later, I didn't tell Richie that I was joining, but I sent in an application.
So there's no one official group called the alt-right, but one of the main groups, the one that Sam was looking into at the time, was called Identity Europa, or for short, IE. This is a group that was formed in early 2016 as Trump was running for president.
At the time when I joined, I really thought that it was just going to be like a pro-white community where we could talk to each other about being who we are and I guess gain confidence and build a community and, you know, exchange recipes or visit each other. And just it kind of becomes like a chat, just like anything else, any sort of like, you know, go on meetup.com. And that's what it felt like it was going to be.
Sam first joins IE in December 2016. And basically, as soon as she joins, they start wanting her to do more and more stuff within the group. Partially, this is because she's a woman, and they really wanted more women in the movement. At the time, there were only about half a dozen women in all of Identity Europa. So she starts getting more and more involved, proving herself, and within just a couple months, she has become the women's coordinator of all of National Identity Europa.
So it would just be generally like, I think I tried to do like a question of the day. And so sometimes it would be like, what's your favorite meal? Or who's your favorite classic Hollywood actress? What's your favorite perfume? What kind of music do you like? Any sort of, you know, just thing to get women chatting and to make them feel like they were a part of a community. If women had problems, they would call me if, you know, or message me and I would, you know, give them counsel.
What kind of problems would they call you with?
It could be honestly anything. You know, they met a man and the man wanted to be physically intimate and they were torn between wanting to be intimate with him but not wanting to be looked down upon. Or, you know, they don't know how to talk to their family about their views, or they're having, you know, they I remember one woman said that she had to go to a birthday party for a Jewish sorority sister. And like, how does she reconcile that in her head that she still has Jewish friends, but.
Oh, really? I didn't know about that one.
Yeah. It was, you know, there was just a lot of stuff like that, that, you know, what, you know, my family's coming over. How do I bake a good meal so that I could tell them that I'm an identitarian? Anything like that.
So not long after Sam joins the movement, she and Richie break up, and this leaves her feeling pretty lonely, pretty cut off. And even though IE is an online movement, they are also interested in forging community in real life. So they start planning a big event to try to get everyone together, a big rally. And the place they choose to do it is Charlottesville, Virginia. So this was not the big Charlottesville rally that everybody remembers. This was the precursor to that. This one was in May 2017, the first one. And the purpose of it was the same as the one that would come later. It was, they all wanted to get tiki torches, light them, and bring them to this statue of Robert E. Lee, and they wanted it to be a public statement.
I drove up with a few people that were also from my region, and we got this Airbnb at a vineyard. And so we drive up, and I remember thinking that no one was going to notice me. And I go in and we give our names. And I just remember being so confused because everyone would like give one name and then they would give another. So it was either like their internet name, like their alt-right pseudonym, or their real name. And they'd be like, hi, my name is like, you know, John. Oh, I'm kidding. I'm actually so-and-so. Or hi, my name is so-and-so, but my real name is blank. But anytime that anyone found out like my alt-right name, they were like, oh my God, like, I can't believe it. You're a you're the women's coordinator. Can I get my picture with you? Can I get this? Can I get that? Like, I have so much respect for what you do. You're doing God's work, all of this stuff. And it just, it felt insane to be going through all of this stuff. And I had just gone through this breakup with Richie. I felt so lost and so insecure again. And the movement was really all that I felt like I had. I had isolated myself from my real friends, like my real life friends who were normal. And so all I really had was the alt-right. So to have them praising me and telling me that I'm like this incredible person, I've helped them and I've inspired them. Meanwhile, I've pretty much done nothing. It just felt so good.
So after all the marches and banquets and everything, that night, they go back to the Airbnb and they have this big party. You know, everybody was there, all the big names in the movement, including Richard Spencer, who was kind of the biggest, most public face of the entire movement. And so she felt flattered when Richard spent the whole night kind of attending to her.
I think I went out onto the porch to smoke a cigarette or something, and Richard Spencer and I had started talking, and we just started talking about ideology. And again, like, it was just one of those things, like, he's great at rhetoric, and he's great at conversations when he wants to be.
You know, they're at this house party, you know, they shared a cigarette and they were kind of having this bantery conversation. She went inside the house and was standing in this big room with all these young guys who were all hopped up and energetic, and Richard Spencer walked into the room, and this one kid just said, Sieg. And another kid said, Heil. And they're pointing at Richard Spencer with this stiff-armed Nazi salute.
It started with like, hail, victory, or Sieg, and then everyone would say, Heil, Sieg, Heil, Sieg, Heil. I don't know, there was just this energy in the room. It was palpable. Like, you could have eaten it. It was so intense.
Sam had this moment of, like, she always said that she wasn't into Nazi stuff. and that that was over the line and that was inappropriate. And yet now she's in this room where there's just dozens and dozens of people, like, at this fever pitch of, like, doing this kind of ritualistic thing. This is the one thing they're not supposed to do. This is the one thing they can't do in public. And they are high on the just sort of transgressive energy of it. And Sam describes this one moment where she looks over and sees Richard Spencer as this is happening. And he looks back at her and gives her this sort of raised eyebrow look, like, so, are you going to do it?
He was staring me dead in the eyes. And I did it.
Samantha's story continues in a moment. This is the New Yorker Radio Hour.
Hi, I'm Roz Chast from The New Yorker. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by NetSuite. Okay, quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on delivering your product or service, the more money you keep. Obvious. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. So to reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified platform. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/New Yorker. netsuite.com/New Yorker.
Hi, it's David Remnick. As the 2024 election draws near, it's more important than ever to understand exactly what's happening in American politics. The New Yorker offers definitive reporting and analysis by some of the best writers and political thinkers watching the campaign. Commentators and reporters, including Susan Glasser, Jane Mayer, Jelani Cobb, Masha Gessen, Evan Osnos, Ben Wallace Wells, and many more are providing incisive analysis that you don't want to miss. Subscribers get unlimited access to all of it. And we're offering a deal just for podcast listeners, 15% off a yearly digital subscription. Visit newyorker.com and use the code POD15. That's POD15. For 15% off a digital subscription to The New Yorker.
Welcome back to The New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. We're hearing an extraordinary story about a young woman named Samantha who was radicalized into the alt-right. And within the span of just a few months, Sam made her way into the leadership of the white nationalist group called Identity Europa. When we left off, Sam was hanging out at a party with Richard Spencer, the neo-Nazi organizer, and a crowd of people shouting, "Sieg Heil!" But about 6 months after that party, Samantha, who was thinking about leaving the group, reached out to staff writer Andrew Marantz. He's covered the alt-right for The New Yorker, writing about 4chan and neo-Nazis and others, and his new book on extremism in the internet is called Antisocial. When Andrew was reporting, he kept finding it wasn't easy at all to get members of the alt-right to sit down for interviews.
So I had been putting out feelers for a while in this world. I was trying to find someone who could really just tell me honestly what it was like inside the alt-right, not give me spin or movement propaganda, but just what their experience was getting in and ideally getting out. And I had not had much luck. And so one night I was sitting at work, I was in the conference room actually, and I got an email from this anonymous person, this anonymous woman basically saying, "I don't know if you've heard about me, but I'm trying to leave the movement. And I'm like physically about to go on the run because essentially when I leave, I don't even know if I'm going to be physically safe."
Hello?
Hey, sorry about that.
Do you want to talk?
And I said, "Yeah, I want to talk."
He was like, "Yeah, I just crashed with you for a few days, so I've just been kind of in and out of different places right now until I think I have like 5 more days until the place that I will be renting is ready.
Okay. And so I think it's like super interesting to be where you are. I know interesting is like maybe a trivializing word for a very scary moment in your life, but I do think it's, I don't know. I don't think this thing has been around long enough where people can go in and then go out. Well, I've never thought there was someone in your position.
Yeah.
In a way, I felt like her story was kind of too good to be true. Like, I felt like, why would someone reach the upper echelons of the alt-right movement and then go run and tell some Jewish journalist at The New Yorker their whole life story? Like, there are professional organizations on the far right that try to trap mainstream journalists into believing false stories. This is like a thing that happens at scale. So I didn't really trust her, and she, of course, didn't trust me.
You know, but when you're sitting here presenting ideal, like, I'm telling you, like, I'm being pretty vulnerable with you, you know? And it's like, I have not done that with anyone. Yeah. And
yeah. No, I agree. I mean, look, this is going to sound kind of weird and like Forrest Gump-ish, but like, ideally, I would really, if we were going to really have a real conversation, it would be in person.
I mean, but, like, where do you even live?
I live in New York. I mean, I would like, get on a bus and come see you if you had time to really sit down.
I get in my car. I drive to this random town in Maryland and meet her at this hotel lobby. And we just sit and talk. And she shows me photos and audio files and videos. And the more we talk, the more it becomes clear to me what she's saying is all true. Obviously, by the time Sam contacted me, things had changed for her pretty dramatically. After a little less than a year in the movement, she now wants to get out. But I spent a lot of time trying to piece together exactly how she got to that point. So it wasn't like there was some Hollywood moment where she just, the clouds parted and she realized that she had been a racist all along. It was a process. But there was one big turning point that set her on the road to getting out of the movement. And that was when this group that she was in called Identity Europa started helping to plan another big rally in Charlottesville, Virginia. This was the big one that you've heard of, the Unite the Right rally. So every day as this rally got closer, Sam started to doubt more and more whether this event was going to be a good idea.
Plenty of us were talking to each other saying, like, this is not going to end well. There's just no way. And that's not even accounting for opposition. Like, that's just within the movement itself. We all knew that it was going to be a mess.
How could you tell?
The first rally was only done by IE with invite. Like, it was like an invite-only thing, basically. And so it was all done under, like, this one roof. So everyone shared the same common vision of, you know, we're just going to go, we're going to protest this. And then with the Unite the Right rally, it was like, we're going to invite literally everyone on the right. And whoever shows up, do whatever it is that you do. There was so much at that point in 2017 with that ball rolling of like what the alt-right was and what it meant. And people were breaking off and going into different factions and wanting to distance themselves from this group because they're too violent or they're too out in the open about their Nazism or whatever. That no one was willing to, like, cooperate.
So she was having serious doubts about this alt-right demonstration. But the other thing that was going on is she was in this new relationship, actually with the leader of Identity Europa at the time. And things in the relationship are going south pretty quickly. They have been living together, but when she tries to break up with him repeatedly, he essentially just refuses to leave her apartment.
We, you know, were not sleeping in the same room. We weren't, like, I did not appreciate this person at all. If I had point blank said, we're done, I'm done, get out, I could have been exposed. I could have been kicked out. You know, this person had a lot of pull and a lot of, he had told me that he had ruined other people's lives.
Now, the way Sam tells it is that this guy is threatening to dox her, meaning releasing her personal information online. And that is a very powerful threat because even though a lot of people in IE are willing to go to a public rally, they're still trying to mostly stay anonymous online. Like, Sam is not telling people in her family or at her job that she's going around doing Sieg Heils with Richard Spencer. And she knows very well what happens to members of the alt-right after they get doxxed.
Yeah, become a social pariah. Just absolutely become, like, you're quarantining yourself if you get exposed.
So the day of the big Charlottesville rally comes along, and Sam is still not really on board with the rally, but she also has this guy living in her apartment threatening to expose her. So she just says, okay, I'm just going to sit this one out. So she takes a work shift that day.
It was a weekend of street battles and stark displays of racism, exploding into a deadly act of domestic terror. Tonight we examine...
So as all the chaos in Charlottesville is unfolding, as a white supremacist named James Alex Fields is ramming his car into a crowd of people, ultimately killing Heather Heyer, one of the protesters, that's being broadcast on the TVs above the bar where Sam is working.
There were TVs where I work, and it was all over the place. And I remember some coworkers were like, oh, I hope it's those Nazis that are getting... The car ran into someone, I remember that. And they were like, oh my God, a car hit somebody. I hope it's one of those Nazis. So that happened, and when it was confirmed that it was someone who was not in the alt-right, it was a nice, normal person, it just broke my heart.
She just can't really deny it to herself anymore. The bottom line is, this is her team who's doing this stuff. And right about that same time, she gets set up to do an interview with a woman named Glenna Gordon. So Glenna is a photojournalist who shoots for places like the New York Times Magazine, and she was doing this photo documentary project about women in the far right. Glenna was looking for someone who was kind of a leader in this part of the alt-right movement, and she got set up with Samantha. And so they met up at a coffee shop, and they ended up talking for hours. And Glenna really directly challenges Sam on her beliefs in a way that no one really had before. And actually, Glenna gave us that audio.
I am not against the idea of separation. And I'm not against it because exactly like you said,
but
both said, like,
you realize the company you keep when you advocate separation.
Mine.
And the Aryan Nations.
I understand what you're saying, but again, to just do this large blanket of saying like, okay, so the KKK was white advocacy. So that must mean that I have some sort of proverbial bloodline within that. You know?
I mean, you have direct rhetorical identicality. It's like proverbial bloodline or not, like the words that are coming out of your mouth are the same as the words that come out of their mouth.
And what have I done that is similar to them?
You've said the same words.
Okay. So
she was really, since I had joined, the first person that actually dissected and dismantled everything that I said I believed in and held me accountable for it.
And this was when?
Like 3 days after the rally.
Oh, wow.
I remember picking and choosing these things. Like, the points that I was always going to say is, like, no one is white enough. Like, I'm pro-white. I don't hate anyone else. I'm pro-eugenics because I don't want to give society the burden of having children with problems. And there was, like, one other thing. Like, I believe in separation because I want communities to be able to support themselves. Those were the three tenets of the alt-right that I had decided were going to be my platform. Like, why
separation
I'm
separation meaning racial segregation or racial ethnostates.
Yeah, and I just, yeah, like, even, see, like, even now I try to, like, be euphemistic about it because I'm just so embarrassed by it.
Yeah, separate but equal.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely, segregation. And this woman is sitting across from me with her sandy blonde hair and her little California vibe and just saying, like, well, you know, as it turns out, like, you are connected to the KKK and this is actually how, you know, opportunity works and this is how housing structure and school systems work. And I couldn't pretend like this was something that I believed in. And even if it was something that I believed in, it was being taken apart right in front of me. And very calmly, very easily. I just remember at the end of the interview just being like, I'm actually just afraid that you're 100% right.
coming home and being like, I can't do this. I stopped caring about what it meant for me if I left. I knew I would still have to be careful. I knew that I would still have to, you know, cover my tracks and be safe and, you know, be quiet and disappear for a little bit if that's what it took. But I knew that if I didn't leave then, I wasn't going to leave. And so I did. I just resigned. And it took me a few more weeks to get out of the chats. It took me a few weeks to get out of the house. It took me a few weeks to do everything. And then it took me months to even feel like I was fully out of it, like even in my brain.
I remember that time. I mean, I remember you calling me and you still being kind of scrambled up and just kind of just very fragile.
Yeah, I remember I was like simultaneously determined to get through it, but also so resigned to the fact that what if that's just who I was? Ooh.
Yeah.
Didn't realize I had feelings about that still. Sorry.
Yeah. It's not that surprising to me, honestly, because I remember that was when I met you during that time, and you were just so messed up and confused and like, but I also like, I couldn't tell like how much to try to help or how much to be like, should I be angry at this person because she was just doing and saying all these terrible things, or should I be like reaching out to her and trying to pull her out of it? Like, I didn't know how active to be or how passive to be. It was...
Yeah, I remember that. I remember you were the only safe person that I knew.
Yeah. Like, now you can look back and be like, I'm embarrassed or I feel sad or I feel angry at myself or whatever. You have this distance. Back then, you had no distance. So I remember we had this conversation where you were like, look, I know the Holocaust happened, but like, did it though?
Oh my God.
And I was like, yeah, it really did. And you would, I mean, it was so interesting because you'd be like, yeah, I know, totally, I know, you're right. But like, it probably wasn't 6 million though.
Yeah, there was always this like seed of doubt. And like, I think, not in terms of the Holocaust, but like in terms of anything that I hear now that someone claims to be true, I just instinctually am like, yeah, but like how much of that is true? Like I'm just skeptical of everything. But yeah, I mean, it took such a long time for me to like, I couldn't accept facts.
I mean, how do you deal with that now? Like, where do you get your information now? How do you apply skepticism to the information you hear now, but not too much skepticism? Like, how are you?
I mean, I kind of just, there's no one website that I go to. There's no one piece of literature that I go to. I know you want me to read, what is that stupid book by David Foster Wallace that you think I should
read? It's not stupid. It's called Infinite Jest. And when you read it, you're going to come back to me and tell me that I was right, just like I was right about the goddamn Holocaust.
If you... Jesus.
You're going to, you know, you can double down on your disdain for this book all you want, but you're just going to be
like
eating more.
You sound like every guy in his late 20s who really loves the band Tool, and you're like, just give it a chance, man. Lateralis is brilliant. I can't.
Well, it is.
Is it, though? Anyway, yeah, like there's no one piece of literature. You have to think critically of everything.
I've spent a lot of time reporting on groups like this. And, you know, a lot of the people I see get drawn into it, they're just looking for a racist movement to join. And that's all there is to it. But with most other people, it's a little more complicated. Like in Sam's case, maybe they're lost, maybe they're gullible, maybe they want some kind of sense of purpose in their lives. And in a way, even though Sam ended up getting out of this stuff, I still find her story really unsettling because by any measure, someone like Sam, who grew up the way she grew up and had the friends she had and had the political behaviors she had, she should not have gone down this road. And that all points to what I think is a pretty deep and sort of scary question, which is whether any of us can ever really truly know who we are and what we believe. Because if people's beliefs can change in such a core way, then how certain and how solid was that stuff to begin with?
I thought I knew it all. I thought I was above it. I thought I could spot bad ideas from a football field away. I now, to this day, I've had a couple friends send me quote-unquote edgy memes that I know were created by the alt-right years ago. The conversations need to happen. People need to sit down and challenge themselves. And I think it's great that people are so against far-right ideology that they think they're better than it, but I think it's extremely naive and foolish to think that you are impervious to it. No one is impervious to this.
That was Samantha. She left Identity Europa about 2 years ago, and she asked that we not use her full name. Andrew Morantz is the author of the book Antisocial: Online Extremists, Techno-Utopians, and the Hijacking of the American Conversation. You can read him on these topics and much more at newyorker.com. I'm David Remnick, and you're listening to the New Yorker Radio Hour. More in a minute from the actress, comedian, and author, Jenny Slate.
Hi, I'm Roz Chast from The New Yorker. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by NetSuite. Okay, quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on delivering your product or service, the more money you keep. Obvious. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. So to reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified platform. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/New Yorker. netsuite.com/New Yorker.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. Rachel Syme writes a regular column for the New Yorker on fashion, style, and consumer culture, and recently she went to pay a call on Jenny Slate, who was passing through town.
Oh my God, we're on the radio. Hi.
Hi, I'm Jenny.
Hi, Rachel.
Hi, Rachel.
All of the snacks are complimentary, so please feel free.
Jenny Slate is an actress, comedian, author, and one of the most fashionable celebrities I know of. She thinks of clothes as performance, as a form of pleasure, as a blend between play and political statement. Like me, she's a woman who feels the tension between feminism and looking feminine. Her Netflix special and her new book, Little Weirds, both deal with that. I asked her to read a passage from her book.
Hello. I changed from the white cotton nightgown with light blue embroidery on the collarbone into a very smart outfit for living in the day. A cream-colored skirt with a grid of white and pleats all the way around, an accordion of cotton. The pleated skirt is the color of tea with lots of cream. Traditionally speaking, it is the color of tea with too much cream and sugar in it. The skirt is the tone of a slightly warm dessert drink hiding in a cup, a secret, gentle, creamy treat for me while everyone else drinks a darker, more serious, scalding thing.
Jenny is currently on tour for her book. And since clothes are so important to her, I went to her hotel to rifle through her suitcase and see how she packed.
So what kinds of thoughts were you having when you put these things in the suitcase for this tour?
That really everything should try to be as navy colored as possible because that's a color that makes me feel like I'm doing better than I probably am.
So navy is a theme of this tour.
Yeah, it's okay. Like there's not gonna be any like raspberry, you know, like it's just, it's like I need
it's to very
calm
Carol
down.
Channing. Raspberries.
Yeah, I need to calm down a lot, so.
It feels very business-like to me.
It does?
Yeah.
That's like, interesting.
Like, navy to me always feels like it's the color of, like, flight attendants. Because well, it feels navy, like you're going, yeah.
I was just going to say the navy is not a joke. It's just not a funny color. Like, I remember when Betty White came to SNL and she was the host, and she would only wear aqua. And she was like, because that's the only funny color. I was just like, what?
Aqua is a really funny, who has ever taken aqua seriously?
And this here is a white cotton blouse. Hold on. So the collar is always starched and I button it all the way up to the top and I like it to be tight around my neck because it makes me feel like a nice like swan or a duck or something like
that.
So
you're a top buttoner.
Mm-hmm.
I wonder what kind of person you were imagining that you would feel like on this book tour, in so much as like, does it feel academic, studious, or more like a celebratory, like coming out party for your book? Or what was the sort of, you know, image you had in your mind that you projected as you were packing these things of yourself as an authoress?
I know who I am. I know what's going on.
Yeah.
I'm not freaked out.
Mm-hmm.
And I think I'm allowed to be here. It's a lot more mature than I sometimes, not that I feel immature in my mind, but sometimes I feel like vulnerable like a child. And so I think it's important, like when I travel, I really, really dress like a woman who, you know, knows where her checkbook is and doesn't have like a purse full of trash.
A sweater vest is an item that I feel like is not often seen in the wild.
I'm really into vests right now.
Mm.
And I think that I might be having just like a big, big, big reaction to what quote unquote sexy clothes are supposed to look like. Like more and more I want to turn away from things that are, I don't know, like I just feel like they're designed for men or for a certain man, I should say, to be fair. I actually think it's really sexy to wear a sweater vest.
It's kind of collegiate.
Yeah.
Like it's a little bit like secretarial.
Yeah, I just think it's sexy to be like, this is like the sweater vest itself is a beautiful object. And
yeah.
I think it's a sexy move to say, I know what beauty is and I put it on myself. And that entire conversation has happened with me and myself about how I want to look when I look at myself in the mirror. And I start from there. And you'll be lucky to be included in that. And when I dress, I am role playing in a
sure,
way.
Sure. Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, I wanted to ask you a little bit more about that. Like, you know, clothes are definitely part of it, but I just this sense of getting up in the morning and figuring out sort of the what you're going to be.
Yeah.
It's a process of self-construction, right?
Yeah. And I don't know. I mean, first of all, right now I feel like I have this special out and my book and that I have been like talking about myself constantly for 2 weeks. And now I feel like I'm like just sort of like a douche. But but I'm very interested in this conversation. But I'm about to say something that could be douchey. But it's that sometimes my eyes pop open. I'm so pumped to be alive again, which happens to me every morning. I love waking up. And then I just feel like the dreams are still echoing in my mind. There's like a lot ahead of me that I have forgotten about half of it. And I feel overwhelmed. And dressing myself is like a very, very important part of settling down. Like you just put on this lovely silk blouse over here, for example. It's really, really beautiful. But I put that on and it's just like a balm, but in the form of a blouse. And sometimes it's very hard for me to deal with who I am while I'm picking out the clothes.
Mm.
Because sometimes I'm a person that deeply needs to please other people.
And so you're cognizant of the idea that you'll be seen?
Yeah. And so it's like, okay, am I going to pick something that I'm choosing and maybe no one would ever know, but because I'm begging for acceptance? Or am I picking something because it just makes me feel comforted and in control? And I try to go for the second one all the time because it is, I think, a fool's errand to try to anticipate what other people are going to like about
although how you that look. Lesson is like fairly hard won.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I hardly ever learn it. That's why, you know, every day. But I'm learning it again. But I will say that there is something about talking about fashion and the way that you want to do it and that I want to do it with you that it's really a question of how are we sustaining ourselves? How can we be here? And how can we remind ourselves that the details are the things that create a better experience out of something that could have just been neutral or something that could have felt heavy as a default?
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting to me because I feel like the way that writing about or reading about or thinking deeply about fashion has been sort of sidelined into this it's not for me category is so mm-hmm. funny to me because it's one of getting dressed is one of the only universals in our culture. It's like when people are like, I don't care about fashion. I'm like, well, you cared about fashion this morning when you didn't leave your house naked.
Yeah.
It's so funny to me when it gets sort of like put in this box that people don't want to touch.
Have you ever read anything that Virginia Woolf wrote about like frock consciousness?
Yes. Yes.
Yeah, you know, like there was a moment when basically like dresses became buttoned down the front and the garments changed and you didn't need someone else to help you get dressed. And it didn't signify whether or not you were rich or poor. You know, like the bustle is gone now. And so there's this idea of the power that you have when you get your own self dressed.
You know, certain women always dress themselves who are like the ladies in waiting, but the...
Right.
You know, there was a sense of you would have a dresser if you wanted to wear anything like personal finery wise.
Mm, right.
And there was a shift into buying your own personal finery and being in your own personal finery. And Virginia Woolf, like notoriously, did a lot of writing in her head when she would go two neighborhoods over to the market to buy stockings for herself. It was her favorite errand.
Mm.
So she would often, she was like very invested in making trips to find things that she wanted, you know?
Yeah.
It was a pilgrimage for her.
Yeah, I'm in charge of my own finery.
Yeah.
Thank you,
guys. Oh, thank you.
The New Yorker's Rachel Syme speaking with Jenny Slate. Slate's comedy special Stage Fright is on Netflix, and her new book is called Little Weirds. I'm David Remnick, and that's our show for this week. Have a terrific Thanksgiving, and please join us next time.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is a co-production of WNYC Studios and The New Yorker. Our theme music was composed and performed by Merrill Garbus of Tune Yards, with additional music by Alexis Quadrado. This episode was produced by Alex Barron, Emily Botine, Ave Carrillo, Rhiannon Corby, Karen Frohman, Kala Leah, David Krasnow, Caroline Lester, Louis Mitchell, Michelle Moses, and Stephen Valentino, with help from Morgan Flannery, Allison McAdam, Mengfei Chen, and Emily Mann. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported in part by the Chirina Endowment Fund.